574, George Zielinski against Columbia 300 Incorporated. Mr. Prince.
May it please the court. As the court introduced me, my name is Todd Prince. I represent Columbia 300 Incorporated, who's the cross appellant, aligned with the appellant and herein and the defendant in the trial court. The cross appellees, George Zielinski Jr. and Pinbreaker Inc., were the plaintiff in the trial court. For convenience, I'll refer to the parties as Columbia and or Zielinski for plaintiff and defendant. The court is aware this is a trademark infringement suit tried to a jury for 5 days in October of 2001. It is Columbia's position that this case should not have ever gone to the jury, and that there's insufficient evidence to support the jury's findings on damages and on Columbia's affirmative defenses. I'm going to divide my argument into three parts. First, did Zielinski overcome the presumption of abandonment? Second, was there sufficient evidence for the award of actual monetary damages in this case? And third, was there sufficient evidence to support the jury's findings on the affirmative defense of acquiescence? The very pertinent facts are that Mr. Zielinski trademarked the Pinbreaker name in 1994. In 1996, however, Mr. Zielinski sold his factory that manufactured bowling balls under the Pinbreaker name, all of his equipment for such manufacturing, and ceased to manufacture, whether in his factory or anywhere else, bowling balls, or selling or advertising any bowling balls bearing the Pinbreaker name. Later, in 1996, after all these sales took place, Mr. Zielinski, the plaintiff, and his father, also an officer of Pinbreaker Incorporated, the other officer, came to San Antonio, Texas, and met with officers of my client, Columbia 300 Incorporated, to discuss potentially using chemistry for bowling balls that Mr. Zielinski had developed, and or manufacturing and selling bowling balls bearing the Pinbreaker name in Korea, as there was believed to still be a market there. The defendant, Columbia, did manufacture some bowling balls bearing the Pinbreaker name, dealing with Mr. Zielinski's agent in Korea, a man named Mr. Hong of Pinbreaker Korea, and sold some bowling balls in 1997. Unfortunately for everyone involved, the Korean economy collapsed. There were no more sales. At the end of that year, officers of Columbia 300 Incorporated called Mr. Zielinski and asked how to make the royalty check to be paid. At that point in time, this lawsuit began, claiming that there was no authorization to manufacture those bowling balls bearing the Pinbreaker name.
On this whole abandonment thing, the only reason they stopped manufacturing them was because of this ongoing infringement case that they were involved in. And those seemed like fairly prudent things to do.
Your Honor, pulled back while
that lawsuit ran its course, didn't it?
Your Honor, they sold their equipment prior to that lawsuit and sold out everything and stopped advertising, marketing, or doing anything then. And an important point to note about that infringement lawsuit, which is the Gentilomo lawsuit,
yes,
it was brought against every manufacturer in the bowling ball industry. Everybody was being sued. This man had what they called, I believe, a submarine patent has been the fight. And in fact, it's still ongoing. He's filed some motions for reconsideration that have been denied. The testimony at trial, the testimony from the representatives of Columbia, who were also defendants in that Gentilomo lawsuit, was that they did not stop manufacturing bowling balls. They did not stop their sales and their production of bowling balls. Obviously, the other companies out there in the country didn't stop either.
But isn't a fair view of the evidence that the jury could have concluded that they just suspended its operation, didn't completely abandon it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And the case law is that there has to be something more than a subjective statement of intent that, yes, someday I'm going to use the trademark again. As the courts have said repeatedly, and as the Emergency One Court has said, that you have to show that you're going to resume within a reasonably foreseeable time in the future. And furthermore, on the issue of the Gentilomo case, the plaintiff himself testified that it was, quote-unquote, a fraudulent case and utterly without merit and frivolous. If it had
well, that's what you think this case is, and they want a big verdict against you.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But I don't believe that this was fraudulent, and it certainly did not chill us from to the point where we stopped using our trademark. The bottom line is, from the period of 1996 through the trial of this case in 2001, and I'm assuming even as we stand here today, there has been no effort or attempt to resume the use of the Pennbraker trademark. The only excuse presented, the only reason presented, and presented late in the game, I might add, is that of the chilling effect of the Gentiloma lawsuit and the fact that it stopped us from producing. There were no injunctions entered. There were no temporary orders or anything like that. It was a patent lawsuit against all manufacturers of bowling balls, against everybody out there. And the only one who supposedly stopped making bowling balls because of this, according to his testimony, was Mr. Zielinski and Pennbraker. Everybody else kept making bowling balls. And the test is you have to look at what a reasonable businessman with a bona fide intent to use this trademark in the future would have done. I believe in light of that, in light of the testimony of those who kept manufacturing bowling balls in the face of this, a reasonable businessman would, in the face of what he believes to be a totally fraudulent and frivolous lawsuit, resume the use of the bowling ball. In fact, the Gentiloma lawsuit was at one time resolved during all of this. There was no resumption of the Pennbraker trademark, and then all the motions to reconsider were filed by Mr. Gentilomo, and he's still sending letters to the court, even though there is final disposition of that matter. That is the only evidence presented to rebut the presumption of abandonment. It is the position of Columbia 300 that that is insufficient evidence to rebut that presumption. It does not rise to the standard of what a reasonable businessman with a bona fide intent.
Well, the burden of proof still rests with you, though. They have to come forward with some evidence that they didn't abandon, and their testimony is that they planned on continuing. And it, you have the ultimate burden of proving abandonment.
I'm in agreement, Your Honor. And as cited in our brief, the standard of review for that is that a mere subjective intent, mere testimony by the holder of the trademark that, yes, someday I plan on using it again, does not defeat the evidence that we presented. Because if that were the case, if you could simply say, yes, I was going to use the trademark again, there would be no affirmative defense of abandonment, because everybody would testify, well, yes, someday I was going to use that. The evidence that was presented, the uncontroverted evidence, was that for over 5 years, there was no advertising of the Pennbraker name. There were no manufacturing of bowling balls by the plaintiff bearing the Pennbraker name. Pennbraker Incorporated had no employee. Pennbraker Incorporated had no sales of bowling balls. They had no equipment. They had no factory. They had no place to even manufacture or make these bowling balls. And there was no use of that name whatsoever in commerce in any way for over 5 years at the time of trial of this matter. That's the evidence of abandonment. And that's what led to, first of all, under 15 U.S.C., the non-use period of 3 years, which led to the presumption of abandonment. And none of that evidence was rebutted in any way during this five-year period that, yes, we started using the name again, or we showed more than mere subjective intent to someday use the name in the future. The only excuse provided was that of the Gentiloma lawsuit, and the only other testimony is that other reasonable businessmen did not allow that to chill them or preclude them from manufacturing bowling balls. On the issue of monetary damages, this court is infinitely familiar, I'm sure, with the web printing case as it was written by this court. In order to recover monetary damages in a trademark case, there must be actual confusion. It's a necessary element. And a result, the plaintiffs need to suffer actual injury, the loss of sales, profits, or present value. There was no evidence presented to the trial court whatsoever of actual confusion. Some witnesses were called in. An important point is that subsequent to selling some bowling balls in Korea bearing the Pennbraker name, there were a multitude of leftover boxes that had been printed on for shipping these bowling balls to Korea. Columbia reused those boxes and on at least two sides would put a sticker over the pinbreaker name and ship whatever was ordered in those boxes. There were three witnesses who testified that, yes, you know, I saw these boxes. These are bowling pro shop individuals, owners or employees. Yes, I saw these boxes with a sticker on the side. All of these people testified on cross-examination that they ordered these Bonanza bowling balls. They got what they ordered. There was no attempt to palm off or pass off any of these items as pinbreaker bowling balls. And in fact, the whole point is there can't be actual confusion when we go back to our issue of abandonment. There weren't two bowling balls on a shelf, one pinbreaker manufactured by the plaintiffs and the other with a pinbreaker label manufactured by these defendants that were confusing consumers. There was no testimony whatsoever of confusion, and when asked on cross-examination, the plaintiff testified that he had never, ever been provided with any questions regarding confusion. Nobody called him up and said, "Hey, George, I bought this bowling ball. I thought it was a pinbreaker bowling ball, and it wasn't." Lastly, and very briefly, as I'm running into my rebuttal time, on the issue of acquiescence, the record shows that the parties met in October of 96 in San Antonio, Texas, that the plaintiffs presented a what they called a pro forma invoice requesting the manufacturer of bowling balls bearing the pinbreaker name for sale in Korea. They call it a pro forma invoice, and I'll call it that, giving them the benefit of the doubt. The evidence, the document that's referenced in the record only says invoice. The record also shows that upon request, the plaintiff sent a box bearing artwork to the defendants to utilize. The defendants utilized that to create the pinbreaker artwork. Columbia worked with Mr. Hong of Pinbreaker Korea. Mr. Hong was Pinbreaker's exclusive distributor and, according to the plaintiff's own testimony, was permitted to use the name Pinbreaker Korea in Korea. That, I believe, satisfies the requirements of agency, and it further shows that the plaintiffs acquiesced to these activities of selling these balls bearing the Pinbreaker name in Korea. Lastly, the plaintiffs themselves introduced Mr. Hong to Columbia for this purpose. They contributed the artwork, they placed the orders, and then Mr. Hong placed the orders for bowling ball. Mr. Hong even went back and forth with Columbia designing the artwork for these bowling balls for Pinbreaker Korea. In conclusion, I believe that the court should reverse the judgment of the trial court in regard to actual damages. Mr. Zielinski failed to rebut the presumption of abandonment. There is more than ample evidence of abandonment and nothing to rebut that. There's no evidence to support an award of monetary damages in this case, and there's insufficient evidence to support the jury's findings on the acquiescence issue.
Thank you, Mr. Prince. We'll hear now from Mr. Kehoe.
Please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Kehoe. I represent Pinbreaker and George Zielinski. Initially, I want to direct the court's attention to the fact that the box that we had used at Exhibit A at trial, in which we had asked the court to tender as an active exhibit to the jury during deliberations, was lost by the district court. There's an affidavit now recently in the file indicating that. So I had hoped to be able to show the vast difference between that particular box and the boxes displayed in Exhibit 32, which shows the pictures of the boxes that they used. But we have described quite at length and without contradiction that the boxes that were used throughout the sale of balls in Korea and in the extra sales in the United States of the Bonanza balls had numerous deletions and changes from the box that my client had tendered to them as part of the negotiations. We say this was part of the negotiations for them to make our client's bowling ball. They had asked for a box. We sent it to them.
Mr. Kehoe, could I suggest you might want to raise your voice a bit? You're competing with a GSA fan over your head.
Thank you, Judge. As I've indicated in the brief, and I won't go into too much detail about it, the box was changed in very substantial ways. The orange circle, most importantly, was changed to TM. The identifying information, addresses, things of that nature, certifications of different different approval authorities, such as the Women's Bowling Congress and others, were deleted, all of which is, as you know, in derogation of the mark. The jury saw these two boxes. They saw the differences between the two. And they also evaluated the question of the defendants sending their own box, their own balls, bonanza balls, which were their seconds. They weren't their first-line balls. And to clarify a point on the bonanza balls, those were never identified to the public as being Columbia balls. Columbia made a practice of not identifying bonanza balls as their own, either on the ball or on individual boxes, because they were their seconds. What did they do? They used their extra boxes with the Pinbreaker name on it, which is their Pinbreaker TM name, and they sent that with their Bonanza balls marked only on two sides, as counsel says, with Bonanza stickers. Well, obviously those Bonanza stickers didn't cover up the name Pinbreaker on the other two sides and barely covered up anything on the two sides that the stickers were on. So what happens, according to the testimony at trial, is these dealers who get the balls, they order Bonanza balls, they ordered them from Columbia, but they didn't order them in Pinbreaker boxes. When they see this, the testimony of at least of one of the witnesses was, well, I thought because I knew George Belinsky and I knew he was talking to Columbia, I guess he worked out a deal with Columbia, and now I'll display the box with the ball for my customers. Well, what does that do but say that Bonanza seconds are associated directly with Pinbreaker, the Pinbreaker mark? They say this doesn't matter. They say that none of that was added to the confusion question or to the question of whether or not there was an entitlement to punitive damages. We say their actions were deliberate in an attempt to misuse and abuse the mark. What they wanted to do and what the evidence showed was that they intended to use the mark for whatever they could get out of it in a market where the Pinbreaker ball sold for as much as $500 in the Korean market. That was uncontested. That testimony made it clear that this ball was valuable. They wanted to introduce it with cheap balls under a name that sold for very expensive money and sell as many as they could in Korea, and then thereafter, once caught, destroy the mark. And that's exactly what essentially our expert said that they did, and which had to be rehabilitated by corrective advertising and by this evaluation as to what the actual compensation should be for the balls sold. Now, on the actual damage question, our expert said, well, their high pay under their own agreement, proposed agreement, was $7.30 a ball. Since there was no agreement as to cheap balls versus expensive balls, he said $7.30 should be the set number because nobody agreed to lesser, and that would be a minimum amount of damages that my client should get on the actual sales. As far as the corrective advertising, it was a remainder of $43,000 or something, which in the jury verdict of $70,000, that remained for the cost of corrective advertising. Our expert said $80,000 was necessary for corrective print advertising. The jury took half the number, essentially, and said, well, we think that's necessary. Well, that's a very reasonable number. Under the circumstances where they don't have an expert to say differently, they never had an expert at trial to say our expert was wrong in his cost evaluation and his analysis of what was necessary in corrective advertising.
Did they challenge your, I know they have a Daubert challenge now, but did they challenge your expert on Daubert grounds prior to trial?
Yes, they did, Judge. And that was
and
not...
And after they got an adverse ruling, they did not bring in their own expert.
Right. They never presented their own expert to do anything in terms of countering our expert. And their arguments that it was that essentially his opinion was junk science, well, get someone to say it. You know, our expert based it on known accounting principles and went through a detailed analysis of how he reached his numbers. The jury accepted it, the judge has accepted it, and quite frankly, you know, there's no reason to overturn that decision, especially when they didn't go to the effort of having an expert to say there was some other reason to doubt that opinion. Now, with regard to what has been said by counsel concerning the Gentilomo case, the record was clear that part of this meeting in 1996 between Columbia and my client was to talk about Gentilomo. It was such an important issue that they were meeting and took a lot of time talking about how to counter Gentilomo's allegations, which, if found to have viability, would have submarined millions of bowling balls in the industry, including virtually all of my client's bowling balls made to date. Now, my client had the opportunity, around the time that Gentilomo was threatening to file a lawsuit, to sell his equipment and plant at a profit, which you can rarely do on used equipment. He was actually going to make a couple $100,000 on selling, and he did make a couple $100,000 selling the equipment, backing off from the industry for the time being because it was a small operation, and seeing what happened with Gentilomo. He wanted to see, am I going to be at risk here on this Gentilomo case since I'm making a profit on selling my equipment now and can do this and get back in and make it in my own plant later when Gentilomo is over. I'm going to withdraw here, and then I'm going to negotiate with another company such as Columbia, which he did, to make the bowling balls and then have them go at risk. If they're going to, the agreement would have been, or to some extent if it had ever been arranged, that if you use our mark, you're going to use it with the understanding that if Gentilomo has a problem, you're going to bear the weight, not us. And the primary emphasis was, from my client's point of view, we want you to use our chemistry for all of your lines of bowling balls, because Columbia made 9 million balls a year, their largest manufacturer in the world. He wanted, my client wanted them to use his chemistry, which is top-of-the-line chemistry. And they admitted it was top-of-the-line chemistry. Ultimately, months after doing their testing, they said, well, it's no better than our best, so we're not going to take it. But they admitted that it was excellent chemistry, and that's what the whole impetus was in terms of our client talking to Columbia, was they had the distribution network and the wherewithal to use that chemistry and also to sell the bowling balls in Korea. And obviously Columbia is not going to withdraw from the marketplace because they have a huge investment, 9 million or whatever balls a year. They're not going to sell their plant. They're not going to stop doing the manufacturing. Neither is Brunswick. They're big. But my client had this opportunity to step back and avoid the impact of Gentilomo, and at the same time, hopefully get somebody else to bear the weight of the sales of his balls, you know, while this case was going on, and then get back into it. As he later says, you know, during the testimony that came out, he does say that, well, we talked to other people, Mr. Hughes in California. We talked to Mr. Patterson in Ohio and about getting together and doing test balls, getting together and doing our establishing a company and getting back into this business when the Gentilomo case is over. And that all came into the testimony. Mr. Patterson was around 2000 through today. They've been doing test balls and getting ready to get back in the marketplace. The Gentilomo case, however, counsel wasn't quite correct in his description of what's happened with that case. Most recently, the appellate court sustained the summary judgment on all issues but one, and now has that back in the district court. Mr. Gentilomo, however, lost his counsel and is pursuing pro se mandamus issues because he lost about 85 or 95% of his case. But the rest of it still remains in the district court, and my client remains at risk, as do Columbia and Brunswick, on that remaining part of the case. Now, it's not as big a risk as it was because he had counsel pursuing it vigorously before, but it's always been a serious problem in the industry, and the testimony throughout the case from both sides was that this was a major issue of concern that we spent a lot of time strategizing. Now, I think it's clear that the abandonment and acquiescence issues, the judge upheld the jury. The jury was clear in their decision. They answered special interrogatories that made it clear that they believed our end of the case and did not believe whatsoever what the defendants were saying. So I won't belabor those issues. I think the brief is clear, and my brief is clear on those points. With regard to the question on our appeal concerning the punitive damages, now the judge said our focus was on one point, the fact that we had written agreements, they had written agreements, and this oral agreement was something totally different, and that focus essentially was not enough to say that there was this added element of warranting punitive damages. Well, the judge in his opinion on post-trial motions did not talk about many of the other facts in the case. He referred to them, I think, generally as inter alia, and when he talked about why he was giving us costs in the case. And I would point out that when he did give costs, the quote he said was, although not deliberate, which is at page 18 of his opinion, he says, although he didn't believe it was deliberate what the defendant did, he says, it wasn't altogether reasonable. Well, I had trouble with that, you know, and I think you should as well. I mean, I think he's making a judgment call on facts that are in the jury's purview as to what is altogether reasonable at this. Because he referred to the inter alia facts as inter alia, in addition to the fact that both sides who clearly used written agreements suddenly had this oral agreement that that the defendants were claiming. Well, these inter alia facts were much more important than the judge gave them credit for, and one of those things was the bonanza balls, the fact that the bonanza balls were used with pinbreaker TM boxes in the United States. Another thing was the difference in the box. The box that my client gave with the orange circle and the identifying information to the defendants, and the box that they used, as Exhibit 32 shows, and as our physical exhibit at trial showed the jury, these boxes couldn't have been more different. And in fact, the testimony of their witness, Connie Smoot, at trial, the defendant's witness, indicated that she had the box with the TM prepared as a generic pinbreaker box. They never used the box.
If they would have done all these things under the, albeit mistaken, impression that they had an oral agreement here, that none of those things would support punitive damages, would it?
Sure they would, Judge, because there couldn't have been a mistake with the accumulation of facts here. If you start from the proposition, as they say, that we have an oral agreement and we're getting this box that we're supposed to make to use to sell your balls, the first thing they do is don't use the box and change, in derogation of the mark, the pinbreaker TM designation of orange circle to the orange circle to TM, and they take all the identifying information off, which trademark law clearly indicates is a direct derogation of the mark. That is in front of the jury. They see this fact. Okay, on top of that, they use the extra boxes without ever telling our client they have any extra boxes or of any kind, and they send them out with the bonanza stickers on two sides, clearly identifying my client's premium quality mark associated with their seconds, and no identifying information showing that those bonanza balls are Columbia balls. That's very important. That bonanza ball, it has no markings as being belonging to Columbia. So a normal consumer coming up and seeing that in a box with pinbreaker name on it is going to assume it's a pinbreaker box unless he asks further, oh, by the way, is this ball pinbreaker? I mean, he might have a pinbreaker in his closet and say, oh, they made another ball. I'm going to buy that one.
If we were to restore the punitive damages, what would you necessarily get treble damages as well on the
I think it would be quite likely the judge would be required under the law to give us the treble damages. I'd take a look to make sure, but given the counterfeiting here, I do not think he would have an option but to give us treble damages, and then the attorney's fees would be discretionary. But I think it would be clear treble damages would be appropriate.
Going back to the punitive damages,
yes.
The judge granted a JNOV on that, or JMOL on that.
Right.
Yeah. Did he also have the option of simply, instead of granting a JMOL, of simply granting a remitter and having that lower them?
Well, I presume he could have done that. They did not. I don't believe they asked for it. I don't recall. But I suppose he could have. But I don't think, given the fact that the numbers were reasonable under the law, I don't think that the judge really could have felt that he had an appropriate basis upon which to grant the
proportion of punitives to actual pretty high.
Well, I think the law would still support the fact that it was reasonable enough that that it would have been more difficult to do that as opposed to baby out with the bathwater, which he did here. Although, given the facts, that support punitive damages, I think he did not have an adequate basis here either to throw out the punitives. Because in addition to those facts, which I've already recounted, as I set forth in my brief, there was numerous lies testified to by the defendant's witnesses that we caught them making in front of the jury with regard to whether there was an oral agreement at all and who had entered into it. Two of the most important people, Mr. Brad Hunt and the other gentleman, I forget his name at the moment, they testified that, well, we really don't know who entered into this agreement. And it was very clear from the documentary evidence as well, the summaries that they gave of their own actions, that this was contrived, and the jury believed it was contrived. And on top of the derogation of the mark that they perpetrated in the marketplace, both in Korea, where the actual confusion is, as the judge said, and I quoted at page 11 of my brief, the judge's statement as to why, or not page 11, excuse me, page 13, I believe, the sale of these balls in Korea, because they were placed into commerce in Korea as pinbreaker balls, supposedly sold with the approval of pinbreaker, how could there be anything but actual confusion? As a matter of course, I mean, this isn't a situation where they put out a pinbreaker ball with Columbia name on it. This was a blatant situation of using my client's name and changing names, too. That's another thing they did. My client had made a practice of using the pinbreaker name only because he's a small operation, and you use the name to concentrate on the name and make it an important name. They put all kinds of other names out there, the Rebel, and different names and different quality balls. And one of our pictures shows that the balls were such low quality that one of them cracked. There's a picture of a cracked ball that's in Exhibit 32 that we emphasize to the jury. This is such a low quality ball, my client said, I'd never have a ball that would crack in transport. And this one is one of the ones we saw stored in
keep referring to your client as a fairly small player. About what percentage of the market did your client have?
Oh, it's really hard to say percentage-wise. I would less than 5%. I think he sold a couple hundred thousand bowling balls overall, 300,000 to 400,000 bowling balls in the entire time he was making balls. And basically ran into this wall, you know, with further sales, you know, and he is in the process of still trying to get that.
Did I hear correctly that a bowling ball sells for $500?
We had testimony, unrebutted, that the bowling ball in Korea, our bowling ball, sold for $500, yes.
What does it sell for here?
At this time, I'm not sure if the lobbies is not.
What did it sell for here?
Somewhere in the neighborhood of $150, $200. It was an expensive ball.
He only made one type of ball.
Very high quality bowling ball. And they knew it, and it was very popular in Korea.
This is only in South Korea. I assume North Korea is not.
Yeah, North Korea likes to bowl too, I guess, but they don't have much opportunity. There aren't many bowling alleys in North Korea, but in South Korea, yes. And this was just not just South Korea, but Taiwan is where some of these were sold. Bowling was popular there and growing. But in any event, the bottom line here is there are numerous reasons to overturn the judge's decision on the question of punitive damages. I think he inserted his own opinion improperly on the facts, and we're entitled to have that overturned. Otherwise, I think the judge gave a good opinion as to every other part of the case and should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kehoe. Mr. Prins, you have, 7 minutes.
I plead the court, Mr. Kehoe. In rebuttal, the first point about the box that was raised and that there were changes in the artwork that was provided by Mr. Zielinski to Columbia for the recreation of pinbreaker artwork. The testimony is that artwork was put together in conjunction with Mr. Hong of Pinbreaker Korea in order to advertise and sell those balls in Korea. As far as using the other names such as Rebel, etc., that's not exactly correct that Pinbreaker did not use other names on their bowling balls. In fact, Mr. Zielinski testified that when he did have a manufacturing facility and was manufacturing and selling bowling balls in Korea, he used the name Demon on his bowling ball at the suggestion of the same Mr. Hong of Pinbreaker Korea. The further assertion that these Bonanza bowling balls were shipped in leftover Pinbreaker boxes, the testimony was, and the testimony from these people at the pro shops was, they got what they ordered, whether it was shipped in a box that was labeled Pinbreaker, Bonanza, or anything else under the sun. And in fact, the boxes were single ball boxes, were the testimony, and they were shipped in a larger four ball box that were leftover boxes bearing the name Columbia on them, which were the Columbia high-end products, was the testimony at the trial court. So this was simply a case of recycling boxes, and stickers were placed on these boxes, and there was no confusion, and nobody testified they saw this box, grabbed the bowling ball off the shelf, these were shipping boxes, and ran home thinking they had gotten a pinbreaker ball for a great price, and opened it up only to find out they had a Bonanza ball. There's no evidence of palming off or anything in that regard. On the expert testimony on damages, and the fact that no rebuttal expert was offered in that regard, Mr. Cromley testified that he came up with his figures using what he called a reasonableness test. In other words, it was reasonable to do this corrective advertising because the cost was less than the value of the trademark. Mr. Cromley was a business appraiser for Bank One. He would recommend loans, business loans, based upon the value of trademarks. When asked, would you give a loan in that amount, the figure that you came up with, I believe, $300,000 or more, to Pinbreaker, using only their trademark as collateral, his answer, after being prompted by the court to answer, was no. He used, in coming up with this, sales figures. He had to extrapolate numbers. He used sales figures of $840,000 for Pinbreaker for the year 2000, completely ignoring the fact that there were zero sales in 2000, and in fact there were zero sales in 2001 up until the time of trial, and there were $0 in sales for 97, 98, and 99. That is the type of junk science that the courts are trying to stop from coming into the courts, and the mere fact that we did not bring in an expert to contradict that and say zero is zero does not alleviate the fact that we have a right to challenge his testimony both before, during, and after trial. On the final issue of the punitive damages, the court was correct in throwing out that figure. The facts are, as the trial court pointed out, and it pointed out in more detail in our brief, that the dealings between these parties were instituted by Mr. Zielinski, that Mr. Zielinski introduced Columbia to Mr. Hong, the Korean distributor, who put together the deal with Columbia for selling the balls in Korea. Mr. Zielinski provided Columbia with an invoice for the sale of, quote, and I'm using their language, Pinbreaker's language, cheap bowling balls in Korea. Mr. Zielinski Sr. discussed marketing the bowling balls in October 96 in San Antonio. He admitted during that meeting, he sat down kind of away from his son because his son's sensitive about the high-end quality of his bowling balls and talked to Mr. Albritton, the president of Columbia, about selling cheap bowling balls in Korea bearing the Pinbreaker name. Mr. Zielinski had Mr. Hong contact Columbia. We did not contact Mr. Hong directly ourselves. Mr. Zielinski had him contact us. And then Columbia called up Mr. Zielinski and said, how do you want the royalty check made payable? You want it made payable to you or your corporation? What's the better way for you tax-wise? Let us know. The testimony was, he said, I'll call you back. He called back later and said, hey, we never had a deal. And this lawsuit ensued. It's important to look at the Remington Arms case. The Remington Arms case sets forth the standard for punitive damages in Illinois. It says that they're, one, they're not favored. Two, they're not awarded for a mistake. At the very most, we have a mistake here. The testimony, the clear testimony of the Columbia representatives was from top to bottom, we thought we had a deal, we thought we had a handshake, we thought we could make these bowling balls for sale in Korea.
Mr. Prince, as the district court says, there was evidence in the record to suggest that characterization.
Yes.
But your colleague indicates that there's evidence in the record to suggest another characterization, of at least of deliberateness on the part of your client, or at least gross negligence in thinking he had an agreement. Why wasn't the jury allowed to accept your colleague's characterization rather than yours?
Because, Your Honor, that's a characterization. The actual evidence that went to the jury, there was no hidden agenda evidence, no smoking gun memos, nothing to indicate that Columbia was sitting back there twirling their mustache saying, we got them. We don't have an agreement, but we can do this. And that is the utter absence that I believe the trial court predicated its decision on, and the utter absence of evidence that I'm predicating my rebuttal on. And the fact of the matter is, I've not heard nor have I read any specific evidence showing that Columbia acted with any type of gross negligence or malice or the level of outrageous conduct that the Remington Arms case requires. Outrageous conduct is almost criminal in nature, as Remington Arms said. And at the very worst, we had a company that did a deal on a handshake and really had some internal communication problems. At the worst, but everybody testified they thought they had a deal, and in fact, their own distributor in Korea thought there was a deal because he kept contacting Columbia and designing artwork and getting those bowling balls to Korea for him, bearing that Pinbreaker name.
What is your position on the question of remittiture? Could the district court have granted a remittiture as opposed to JMOL in this issue?
Yes, the district court could have. I believe without a full assertion, Your Honor, and I could give you a letter brief on what we did on that, but I believe that was alternative relief requested, but we primarily asserted that there was no evidence to support punitive damages.
Thank you, Mr. Prince. Indeed, the court thanks both Mr. Prince and Mr. Kehoe for their fine briefs and presentations today, and the case will be taken under advisement.